the Regenerative Hour.
This is a new podcast series that we've started because we feel that really there is a need that we sometimes take that step back and have a look at the bigger picture of things. In the Sustainable Hour this week, we talked with Dr. Jeff Barry, who has sent in a letter. He's written a letter like a template for something that we could all be sending to our bosses or employers and so on, if we want to explain why we are going on strike for the climate on the 20th of September. So I asked Jeff to explain why did he write this letter, and that took us out on a longer and I think really deep and interesting chat about these things that, in my opinion, really, really matter when it comes to understanding which direction it is that we have to go, about how we need to be better at connecting with nature, and not just with nature, but like Jeff is saying it, being at home in the universe. But first, at a more practical level, I asked Jeff to tell us a little bit about his background so we know where he's coming from.
My background, I guess, for the last 15 or 20 years, I did a PhD, which was in academic language in eco-critical work, which meant looking at the literature and the history of the development of large-scale societies like we have today, and asking a simple but profound question: what does this say about our relationship to nature? And through that, I became an academic almost by accident. I really enjoyed teaching in literature and philosophy, and I found the students were very engaged with that kind of material about the human relationship with nature, and they weren't really getting a lot of that in their university education, so I was kind of filling that gap for them out of my personal, you know, passion and convictions. And then, life changed as it does. My position became redundant, and I wanted to keep working with that kind of material, but maybe be a little more entrepreneurial and take it out to people more. I'd also had a lot of interest through my work in ecotherapy, so actually using time in nature and meditating on our relationship with nature for a way to people, not just to feel better, but actually to feel more connected as a way of deepening their experience of being human, and also as a way of hopefully, you know, alleviating some symptoms of separation and alienation, and just as importantly for me, you know, playing a part in an environmental movement in a form of activism as engaged members of humanity on behalf of nature, our home. So that's when I started the business Nature Calling and started to offer ecotherapy sessions and retreats and so forth. That partly came out of my work as the Australian representative for the International Eco-Psychology Society as well. That was part of my background. So yeah, I'm just doing that kind of stuff as much as possible. But I live on the south coast of New South Wales now, although I was from Melbourne. So I certainly get my exposure to nature, and that's been fantastic. But I guess as we hear more and more of the news, through the IPCC reports, and then, you know, through almost everywhere now about how bad the environmental situation is, it just makes it more immediate for me. I guess that's the feeling of immediacy is what led to the letter.
And tell me about the letter then. You wrote a one-page letter which is asking.
Yeah, well, it's more to any worker. It's not so much addressed to management. It's more to the people who I think might be most motivated, the people who care and wish that their places they worked, or, you know, and it can be adapted. I put it online and I said, look, adapt this as freely as you like. I have no attachment to ownership over the wording. I just thought it was helpful for anyone in a workplace or a school or even a society or a club to get out to other people with wording that said, hey, you know, we have something we need to do here. This is a very important moment in time. It's maybe the most important moment in human history. And normally I would think that would sound really over the top, but I believe it's probably the case. a way to just get out to your colleagues and to your management and to say, if we're going to take this seriously, we should strike. We should make clear our opposition to ongoing development in the face of all science and reason. And we should say we need to change now and we need to be a part of this. And so the letter was, you know, worded in a way that said, we don't have to be, we don't have to put things at risk. You know, I work in a, my day job at the moment is a kind of a social work type thing. We help to care for kids. You know, I don't want to see anyone get harmed by this, but we can ask our colleagues and our managers, how could we do this? How could we support the strike in a way that, you know, that doesn't compromise the good work that we do? How can we get the rest of our workplace on side? You know, even if it's just organizing a lunch break where we all go out and join a march or hold up a sign. The most important thing for me was I grew up in Port Adelaide in South Australia, and we always lived near a beach. And I had faced certain challenges as a child, and I found that time on the beach was always really healing. And alongside that, I found that reading was always enlightening, and it woke something up in me that I loved. I had access to a lot of fairy tales. And also, of course, the Jesus stories are always available to kids, I guess. So for me, this idea of magic and wonder and mystery that I got through reading, plus the experiences of spending time at the beach, breathing in the salty air and seeing the creatures and swimming as much as I could, really combined to give me a feeling that you could access a kind of timeless magic and mystery in nature that fed your soul and made you feel naturally better. You know, as a child, you're not looking for healing. You're not thinking about wounds. You just want to feel better. And so I just found through my life, those two things kept coming back together so that when I went to university and I got the opportunity to study mythology and philosophy, it just seemed like a wonderful opportunity to me to open my mind up to a deeper, more adult level, to this same kind of consciousness of magic and mystery. And I'd never lost the contact with nature. I'd always bushwalked and camped a lot. I'd traveled for years at one point in time before university. So that all really came together for me. I really enjoyed going back to university. I'd had a few years out to work and travel. And so, you know, I got my degree in mythology and philosophy. Then I did honors. I was really interested at the time in psychoanalysis. And so I did an honors on how that was a part of the kind of the myth of modern Western society. I then took some time out and I ran a vegetarian restaurant in North Fitzroy in Melbourne with live music, a couple of my other passions. And then when I went back, I did a master's on dreaming, on how our dreams link us to a deeper level of meaning, what Jung would call the collective unconscious. And I wanted to see what part nature had to play in that. Maybe nature was speaking to us through our dreams. Inner nature, our experiences of those archetypal energies, as he called them, those deep patterns. And also outer nature, the environment, how that might be speaking to us if we could attune ourselves to it. That point in time, I hadn't yet heard of Miriam Rose Ungumma's concept of dadiri, or practice of deep listening. I came across that a bit later and it matched very much what I was trying to do by being more silent and trying to listen beyond the babble of my own mind and hear nature if I could. And then the PhD followed straight on, and I just wanted to do something more serious and historical analysis. So the master's in dreaming was creative literature with an analysis, an exegesis as they call it, a kind of a critical system of what I'd done. The PhD, I just wanted to choose one thing and use it to try and figure out what had gone wrong with modern society, not just in the West, but modern global industrial society and our connection with nature. And I did that by analyzing the symbol of light. What does light mean to us? You know, we often find it in as a metaphor for life and consciousness and power and abundance and goodness, you know, light versus darkness and things like that. And I tracked this symbol from ancient Mesopotamia and Egypt through Roman Greece, through Christianity, right up until industrial era. And it was a wonderful opportunity. I'm so happy that I was able to have the time and the space to do a PhD, do some really deep thinking. You know, and also then some time as an academic, and then now some time out in nature doing a different career path. It's all really come together for me. And, you know, and what you hope for after a PhD is you can come back to a simple language, because it's very difficult as an academic to break your language back down to something that conveys to the public. You know, you have to reference yourself and use jargon and technical details when you become an expert in a field. But it's nice now to look back and to kind of see the simplicity of the answer, which I think I've figured out. It's really just that we are separated out from nature. You mentioned before, Mick, you know, this fact that if you live in a city and, you know, you shop at a supermarket, the aisles are always full, at least in the modern West. You know, stuff is always there. It seems like we just have enough all the time. It's very easy to not see the damage we're doing to the environment in order to fill those supermarket shelves and those petrol bowsers and all those other things we rely upon. And therefore, because we don't see the problem, we're not really facing it. And because living in cities, we don't spend time in nature, we're also not feeling our affinity with the rest of nature, with the more than human world, as David Abrams from America calls it. So we lose the loyalty to the earth at the same time as we think we have everything on tap in our cities. I made a doco about that called City Living, Nature Calling, which just pointed out this double-edged sword. We're divorced from nature. We think we can do without it. We've been kind of seduced into an idea of never-ending plenty through technology and industry and so forth. And it's, you know, obviously I think we're starting to see it unravel, and now we can start to wake up to our interdependence with nature.
And how do you drive that forward yourself?
Well, I try through the website, that's just naturecalling.org, to sort of, you know, I blog there about weekly and try to, you know, just give little notations, I guess, to the things I see and try to bring that learning that I've been lucky enough to experience to bear. I offer the courses. You know, there's an online course there, which, to be honest, I'm thinking I'm just going to make freely available. I just feel like the time has come for us to move to another level with our activism. I have people come and see me, so I have clients, and I do kind of ecotherapy and sort of eco retreats and things like that. I run local meditation group where I live. I just try and live the truth that I've discovered and keep trying to disseminate the work out there in any way that I can. I think a part of it is self-care too, you know. We can't individually solve anything, but if we're involved in communities of activism, they always manage to help you to feel better. You feel like you're doing something. So I'm involved in a regeneration project locally where we plant out new estates. You know, we contact the people, the real estate developers and the local council, and we get permission and we go and plant certain areas. I just stay active and try to keep getting the word out there. I recognize the limits to what I can do, so I try not to get too attached to outcomes.
Hmm. What does the word regeneration mean to you?
I think it's a great word for a start, it evolves the idea of building. You know, if we're reconstructing things, we're still thinking about building new things. Regeneration is more something, I think it's a more ecological word. We need to keep regenerating, especially the spaces that have been devastated by development, by overdevelopment. Because, of course, human development is natural. It's natural for us to build things and to change the environment, just as corals do. That's a part of the irony, is that we have to recognize that what we do is natural, but we have to do it more thoughtfully. So for me, the regeneration at a local level partly is replanting, because we know now how damaging deforestation is. But it's an interesting one, actually, that you mentioned this just now. Just last week, I had a conversation with a couple of local Aboriginal elders, and they were talking about cultural burning, how Aboriginal people burnt off, and how that actually helped to regenerate the land. And they showed me some of the stuff they've done, and you could see the new growth coming through where they'd burnt off the old detritus in the forest that had been allowed to gather for years. This was in a national park. So regeneration can also look like something like fire, which I hadn't thought of. I was thinking of replanting, but they're also pointing out something potentially damaging like fire also works to regenerate. Many of your listeners, Mick, will recognize the genius of Aboriginal culture and the way it worked with the environment, and would have heard of these things. But it really opened my mind to the different types of regeneration we can be doing. And of course, we have to do that for ourselves as communities. We need to regenerate communities of people who recognize that this is our home, that we have to take care of it better, that we have to adjust our values to be more earth friendly so that we're not consuming so much more stuff in so many damaging ways. So yeah, I agree with you. I think it's a great word that has a lot of application to where we are right now.
So what we're seeing now that's really pushing an agenda forward is that the youth have come on board, and we're talking kids sometimes like at the age of 10 years, 12 years, 14 years, who are going out on the street and saying, hey, there's something wrong here and it's our future that you are wrecking. What would you say to the next generations coming now in terms of that, as you say, something big is happening, both on the negative side where things are getting destroyed in front of our eyes, but also on the positive side that this is an opportunity to make some major changes culturally as well. But at the same time, we have kids sitting in front of their little screens or in front of their computers disappearing into a digital world, and if you take them out in nature, they will look at up and they'll look down and they'll say, oh, it's boring out here, and they'll pick up their phone and start working on that instead. That sort of thing. So how would you talk to the young generation about these things here?
Yeah, great. Well, look, I'll just pick it up from the screen time and then work back maybe. You know, a lot of research has gone into this where people have spent time out in nature, and they came up with a phrase that our modern culture is 4 days deep, or some people call it 3 days deep. Exactly what you said. They'll go out into nature, especially the teens, looking for their screens. You can't take the screens out there. It's not part of the experiment. And at first, they just don't know what to do, and they think everything's boring. You can imagine it. After 3 or 4 days, you know, the percentage of people, kids and adults, that find a deep reconnection is really high, that remember that they're okay just to be who they are, that can just spend time in nature, listening to the breeze and reflecting and just looking at ants building ant hills or going for swims in rivers or seas, whatever it is, really a big percentage. And so I think, you know, I'm quite old-fashioned on this point. As an eco-psychologist, I have to align myself with a movement that also says, hey, you know what, you don't need to be in nature to reconnect. And that is true. You can be in an urban environment, you can meditate on a pot plant, or you can go for a walk at lunch and find a tree to look at, you know, even in the busiest city block. That's all very true. But I'm also a little bit old-fashioned about this. I do really think we need to continue to remember that time in nature is not something we should feel we need to replace in our lives. If anything, I think we should need to ask governments and ask industry to continue to make sure that the way that we design and develop urban spaces keeps nature in mind. And good urban planners like Barbara Norman at the University of Canberra, who I interviewed for the film City Living Nature Calling, she points this out, that they're doing that now. So you can bring those things together. You can see urban space as a part of nature, and therefore you can help the kids to be looking at trees as well as screens. I think that's really, really important. But, you know, and then to work backwards, you know, this idea of the kids are all right, the youth activism, the Greta Thunberg phenomenon. I mean, I'm just such a big fan of someone, you know, like that, who's just said, here's a problem, I'm going to do something about it. You know, when you see the history of her activism, the very first day she sat on the steps of Parliament in Sweden, completely alone, and then it's just skyrocketed and blossomed, and whatever metaphor you want to use, it's so fantastic. I'm just so impressed. I'm so happy that she's not been ground down by realism yet. You know, she's prepared to simply see the problem and not let go of the fact that something should be done about this. And I think that's wonderful. So I'm always trying to keep on seeking ways to speak that includes everyone. And I've always found, I've taught a lot of undergrad students back in my academic days, and I work with kids nowadays. I'm also a parent. I've always found that if you speak to people, no matter how young, as if they are intelligent and capable of listening, they nearly always are. So I try very hard never to talk down to people. I expect that everyone has the kind of intelligence that can be awake to what's happening in the world, and I usually find that that's the case. So I think the fact that there are many young people that are taking this game up, you know, joining school strike for climate. Another reason I wrote the letter, because I wanted to help that to break out into the work world. You know, I just think that's amazing. And the other thing I like to keep coming back to, apart from just trying to speak plainly and try to make sure everyone has the opportunity to join the movement, as it were, to help protect the earth, is also to keep us reminded of our need for self-care, of our need to take care of ourselves, to be angry and to act, but also to remember that we are part of a consciousness that's ultimately a mystery. It's a magical thing to be a human being, to be in a primate body with a self-aware consciousness. We're in a tiny moment in time on a very beautiful planet in an unimaginably vast universe, which would have tens of millions of other habited planets. Without a doubt, the numbers are simply inconceivably huge. So sometimes I want to come back to that too, that more cosmic level of being at home in the universe and saying, yes, we must do what we can, but we mustn't be ground down by it. We should, you know, we should feel good about being a part of a movement that's got a lot of youthful energy now, because the story's become so clear and obvious. It's not hidden away anymore. Although as much as many vested interests in the mainstream media continuously trying to keep us looking away from the damage and the need of the times, the truth is out. We can take youthful energy. We can take real need for this moment in time, and we can also keep in our hearts our recognition that life is more than this, and we can't let ourselves lose our excitement about just being alive and having an opportunity to do the right thing, to do the good work in the moment. You know, just being able to talk about this, it brings me back to all of those feelings. You know, every now and then we go to work and we get caught up in whatever it is we have to do, our roles, our responsibilities. But it's also good to meditate on that, the biggest picture of all, the cosmic level, and that way come back into our bodies filled with, you know, revitalized with energy.
It's your boy, just one of the guys down here. Well, I could be more specific. I'm a human. And I just wanted to, you know, for the sake of all of us earthlings out there, just wanted to say,
we love the earth, it is our planet. We love the earth, it is our home. We love the earth, it is our planet. We love the earth, it is our home.
Hi, I'm a baboon. I'm like a man, just less advanced than my is huge.
No one knows what I do, but I look pretty cool in my white or black.
I'm a lion cub, and I'm always getting licked.
Meow. I'm a golden avocado. You take milk from a moon.
I'm a fat pig.
I'm a common fungus.
I'm a disgruntled skunk, shoot you out my butt.
I'm a plant, I can get you out there.
And I'm Kanye West.
We
with the sun.
Hippity hop, I'm a kangaroo. How about there, up and down with you?
I'm an elephant, I got junk in my trunk.
I'm a squirrel looking for my next nut.
And I'm a pony, just a freak horse.
Yeah, but,
come on, get on. Yeah,
giddy up, let's ride.
I'm HPV.
Sleep all the time, so what, it's cute.
We love you, India.
We love you, Africa.
We love the tiny.
We forgive you, Germany. Earth.
It is our planet.
We love the earth.
We love the earth.
It is our home.
We love the earth.
It is our planet.
It is our planet.
For so long and still don't know. I hope it's not a simulation. Huh. Give each other names like Ahmed and Pedro. And yeah, we like to wear clothes. Girls still look beautiful. And it covers up our human. Eat a lot of tuna fish. But these days it's like we don't know how to act. All these shootings, pollution, we under attack on ourselves. Like, let's all just chill. Hey. Respect what we built. Hey. Like, look at the internet. It's cracking. It's hey, fellas, don't you let it. Hey. And I heard women are better than a. So what we gotta land for? What we gotta stand for?
Love.
And we love the. Come on, everybody. I know we're not all the same, but we're living on the same Earth.
Have you ever been to Earth?
Everyone who's listening has been to Earth, Ariana. We're not making music for aliens here.
Are we gonna die?
You know what, Bieber? We might die. I'm not going to lie to you. I mean, there are so many people out there who don't think global warming's a real thing. You know, we got to save this planet. We're being stupid.
Unless we get up together now.
Guys, everybody look into whatever the Leonardo DiCaprio is always pushing, because I feel like that guy knows more about the Earth and how we're it up than anybody. Like, if the aliens did come, we should definitely send Leo as our guy, our rep. In fact, the profits that come along with the streams and the sale of this song are going right into the earth. Let's raise some money for charity. Any words, Leo?
This might be my favorite song ever. It's awesome.
Wow. Thanks, Leo.
We love the earth. We love the earth. It is our planet. We love the earth. It is our home. We love the earth. It is our planet. We love the earth. It is our home.
Guys, thank you so much.
Honestly, everybody, scientists are saying that we have about 12 years to turn this environmental crisis around or we're screwed. What do you say? You guys want to save the world? Of course you do.
Rainforests, ecological marvels. Millions of years in the making, rainforests provide water, food, and livelihoods for billions of people around the world. They contain a staggering diversity of life. They create the oxygen we breathe and regulate our climate. They are our life support system. But rainforests are at grave risk. Every second of every day, an irreplaceable rainforest the size of a football field is destroyed. Powerful economic and political interests are driving their destruction to produce beef, palm oil, and paper, wiping out countless species from existence, marginalizing the poor, and deepening inequality, threatening the survival of indigenous communities. And destroying the best solution for climate change that we have. But there is still hope, where a different future awaits us, where faith unites us to make rainforests a shared spiritual priority, where we teach our communities that rainforests are a sacred trust, where we feed a growing planet without converting rainforests, where we work with companies to ensure their products are deforestation free, and where we make sure that governments protect forests and the rights of indigenous peoples. This is the future where we do what is right. But we need to come together, affirm that protecting rainforests is a moral responsibility for all people of faith. Mobilize a movement built on the values we share across our religions and spiritual traditions. Stewardship of the earth and care for creation. A respect for human rights and human dignity. Social and economic justice. The Interfaith Rainforest Initiative is doing just that. From the Amazon to the Congo Basin to the forests of Southeast Asia. Rallying faith communities to act. We must end deforestation because her life depends on it. His life depends on it. Their future depends on it. We all depend on it.
Regenerative Hour.
I'm enough of a scientist to say I see where all the curves are going and they ain't good. But you have to have hope.
If you read the news, you might think that it's all hopeless, but the minute you go outside of your own door, you'll realize that there's tons of hope out there and there's tons of people who are trying to make it happen.
I think there's a tipping point happening now.
We all have a responsibility to put our paddle in the water and help us navigate this modern chapter of our history.
And talk to the 8-year-olds and the 9-year-olds and see the light that's burning in their eyes and the things that they hope from life and how we're enabling them to do things that were impossible for us just one generation ago.
When you see that, when you see someone that's doing everything they can to protect a place they love, it creates a ripple effect.
Love is the answer. Everybody has love in them.
We're part of nature, and we always were. But if we're to support a flourishing future with stunning natural phenomena like the Great Barrier Reef and the Amazonian and other important rainforests intact, with healthy soils and fresh air and water available for all species, then we must put our merely human desires to one side for the greater cause of the biosphere. This is the bigger picture that can make our actions meaningful today. Resisting industries that promote the consumption of more carbon-heavy fossil fuels and acting instead on a more community-minded, eco-friendly scale. Professor Stefan.
The Anthropocene has generated discussion around this anthropocentric versus biosphere-centric view of the Earth. Viewing the Earth as just a bunch of resources to be exploited, rather than an environment that nurtures us and that we need to have responsibility now that we are so numerous and so powerful.
Now we understand that humanity is responsible for changing the Holocene into the Anthropocene. And despite what a lot of corporate-controlled media might have us assume, we've known this for over a quarter of a century. Scientific consensus on the danger that industrialized humanity presented for a healthy planet was established at the Rio Earth Summit in 1992. So why haven't we been busy making these changes since then?
Powerful corporate interests fund capitalist propaganda in commercial advertising, but also in the whole distracting landscape of modern media, to maintain the modern myth that we can enjoy endless growth and the eternal feast. Now that we know that isn't true, it's time to ask ourselves, what deep patterns of our cultural DNA fan the flames of this flight of fancy? Since humanity's experiment with agriculture succeeded in producing higher yields consistently, the Earth began to be seen as a set of resources for our use. And this was a shift from over 90% of all humanity until that time, who saw the Earth as a place that gave us its gifts, from which we grew and we gave it thanks, and we shared our home with all of its other creatures in a system of interdependence.
All animals and plants need sunlight, water, air, and soil to give them life, and in this we are all equals. But then one very intelligent, perceptive, curious, and inventive animal removes itself from that sacred whole to stand above the other elements, to manage them in a way that is profitable, to see the life around it as a set of resources, not a collective of other lives. And because this arrangement creates so much material profit, we are entrained to overlook what people have always known, that what we do to the earth, we do to ourselves. Now that lesson is being revisited upon us, as we look around in horror at what a mere few centuries of industrial society has done to our planetary home, and what it is about to do to us in return.
This warning that the Earth is alive and responsive to our actions is itself a myth. But this is the situation that we find ourselves in as we change stories from an outmoded paradigm of laying waste to the planet in a chase for profit, to a new, more eco-friendly scale of adaptation to the planet's carrying capacity for life, we can't help creating myths, because we recognize that the universe lives through us, that we are connected to it in intimate and meaningful ways that go beyond what the rational mind can comprehend.
We sense a higher order in the chaos of life and death every time we come through something that seems dark and crushing, yet ultimately leads to a rebirth, a fresh hope, or a revitalized sense of beauty. Finding meaning in the unending cycles of nature, even when they seem dangerous or deadly, is natural. So is realizing that we can increase yields of certain plants by collecting their seeds and planting them in rows with a permanent source of fresh water.
The early agriculturalists had stories for this, honoring the earth and giving thanks for good seasons, or growing through the challenges of living in close relationship with the natural world. Until recent times, the environmental damage done by agricultural civilizations was a localized phenomenon, silting up rivers here or extending a desert there.
But when the Industrial Revolution exponentially increased our firepower, we quickly lost all sense that we were still working in partnership with the Earth. Somehow, the combination of coal and the steam-driven engine eroded what was left of the medieval Christian mythology that we were stewards of God's good earth. The ravenous logic of the machine ensured that an alternative reading of Genesis, that we enjoyed dominion over dumb nature, would now hold sway. This attitude went hand in hand with the development of capitalism, which originally grew out of the logic of agriculture, that we can create profit by the sweat of our brow, and, of course, by the ingenuity of our inventions. If we want to find a myth that ties this all together, though, we could shift our focus from the biblical roots of modern industry and look again at the Greeks, because their vision of Prometheus makes sense of firepower, even in the modern age, as both gift and threat. From pre-agricultural hunter-gatherer society to a sky filled with satellites and a space landing on Mars, Prometheus represents our fascination with fuel. As the genius of the psyche, Prometheus symbolizes our love of invention and the risk of taking power into our own hands. The story of Prometheus explains the way we discovered and shared the secret of fire, which must have seemed as if it had come from the sacred realm of the gods to early humans. He is the genius of our own psyche, yet he suffers terribly too, being chained to a rock to have his liver eaten out by an eagle day in and day out for his temerity. Fire is a little miracle, giving warmth and light for cooking and socializing. We gravitate to it like primate moths to a flame. And the evolution of the way we have harnessed its power is long and slow until the modern age. Then, all of a sudden, after millennia of enjoying campfires and using oil lamps with a wick, we jump to seemingly safe, clean electricity in the home at the flick of a switch almost overnight. NASA satellite imagery captures the way our planet looks at night now. We are lit up like 1,000 million campfires, each intensified by the Industrial Revolution and its coal-fired electricity. This beautiful luminescence is also terrifying, because it signifies a kind of monstrous force that is out of control. We've created an enormous factory of fire, a brilliant invention that is now our greatest threat. The way we light up our planet at night symbolizes our fascination with burning fuels. The power of electricity represents our attempt to avoid death and replace the cycles of nature with an endless feast. But alongside what liberation we have created comes a nightmare. And this was captured perfectly by Mary Wollstonecraft Shelley in 1818, when she published her fantastically successful gothic novel Frankenstein, subtitled The Modern Prometheus. What did she mean by this? Like the great Greek demigod, Dr. Frankenstein set out to help humanity through the darkness of earthly life. With the newly discovered power of electricity, the monster he created was designed to show how modern science could cure any disease and even overcome death. But the poor doctor ends up being hounded to the ends of the earth by his ungodly creation. The success of Dr. Frankenstein's experiment turned upon him and became his worst. Are our great inventions likewise created to improve human life, now ruining everything? Combusting fossil fuels fires our machines into action as we chew through the earth, consuming everything in sight while we ride the oil and coal bubbles to the heights of modern civilization and all the creature comforts it has to offer. Anthropogenic climate change shows us the dark side of the mirror as the fires we ignite heat the earth to increasingly uncomfortable degrees. In mythic history, technology is often associated with the abstract masculine realm of the sky, while nature is embodied in the feminine, pictured as Mother Earth. Dr. Frankenstein's daring efforts stole from both realms as he channeled the power of lightning from the sky to give birth to his monster, thereby also appropriating the role of reproduction from woman's womb to the laboratory. According to modern science and medicine, nature remains in its archaic form, feminine and passive, providing us with the raw materials for our very masculine form of human genius. The ancient Greeks looked to the myth of Prometheus as a warning against hubris or unchecked pride. Whether we view the gods as representing natural order or cosmic justice, Dr. Frankenstein's modern Prometheus reveals the character flaw doubled. How much more do we recognize this in the science and technology that has followed? Nowadays, unrestrained corporate greed extracts wealth from every accessible nook and cranny of the planet. And once fossil fuels evolved beyond 19th century British coal, the modern drive to be free of the limits of nature went truly ballistic.
The spirit of freedom has come in many mythic symbols across the ages, from the proud eagle roaming the skies to wild horses galloping across the plains. We've often wished ourselves free of the limits of human nature. But the great symbol of 20th century freedom was the car.
The car is the vehicle of individualism, allowing us to move across the new mythic landscape of city and countryside, going almost wherever and whenever we please. Think about it. We sit just above ground level and fly. Fuel under the hood, carried on the wings of our brilliant invention. The car has been so successful that urban spaces are planned around it. Car parks and new highways are demanded by a populace in love with their freedom machines. It's changed the way the city is planned, and now we've become so used to the backdrop of buildings and roads in grids and the traffic and the technology that comes with it, that we assume this is our natural environment. Hence, the entire point of a myth has been realized. Our reality seems natural. As if we belonged in cities, as if they were ordained.
Remember, a successful myth convinces us that our reality is natural. It doesn't need to follow the rules of logic or even coherent narrative. A myth need not be rational so long as it is convincing. And it doesn't matter if religion or technology supplies the magic trick, the promise that we can be free from the limits of earthly nature.
Either way, in the modern era, we are pushing the planet's ecosystem to the point of collapse. We are Dr. Frankenstein, and cities and cars are our brilliant creation, designed to improve life and now threatening it. A monster chasing us to the brink of destruction with superstorms and rising sea levels, crop failures and drought, fire and flooding events on the increase. Which returns us to the great irony of the modern age. We are now a threat to ourselves and life on the planet due to our enormous success. The real urban myth that we could be free from the limits of nature doubles up on the original Promethean quest, which tapped into unlimited creativity and the spirit of inventiveness in the desire for a better world. But if we retain this promise in an eco-mythic context, new technologies could still lead us towards a 21st century ethic of care for the earth and all its creatures.
So let's pause again and ask ourselves, how can we change the way we do things to avoid an era of unnecessary devastation and mass extinction? And can other valuable ideals, such as those for social justice, be maintained alongside the rush towards environmental sustainability we so desperately need? I asked Professor Barbara Norman, from the University of Canberra, an expert in urban planning in an era of planetary limit, how we could better design cities with a low carbon future in mind.
It's coming to the core of how we behave, the shift about freeing up space, not using our earth for roads, if you like, mm-hmm. for individual car based, but for collective public transport. Mm-hmm. Sometimes people will respond to me now and say, well, there'll all be electric cars and they'll all be run on renewable energy. But actually it's the shift about investing in public transport and shifting from a car-based society. And with that, collective way of living, whole change in the way we design our precincts, design our communities, and a healthier city with that, responsibility and accountability in the way we behave within our bigger environment. We have a scenario where we're creating a whole lot of new cities and expanding existing cities in a dynamic environmentally that's changing as well. And so planners, if we're talking about planners have very much planned cities and towns that we live in a reasonably stable environment. And now we have this new dynamic, which is very significant. And you'll see this, illustrated with some of the impacts of extreme weather that we've seen recently, where we have to think of a whole range of other factors in planning our towns. So we talk about urban design, climate-sensitive urban design.
Barbara adds that urban planting projects also need to be part of a bigger revolution in the way we live today, and that this transformation can combine environmental and social concerns in one.
Well, at the moment, possibly one of the biggest trends in terms of adaptation to climate change, in terms of key measures, would be shading our cities. But one big action is to cool the city. Not only providing an urban landscape for a city as we have in the past and in the present, but scientists, and this is where scientists and social scientists and planners have to work very closely together, planting the species in the city that will be resilient to climate change in the future. But where we can actually work together to find innovative solutions.
Yeah.
And also provide, I would argue, a better city, a healthier city, and a more pleasant city for people to live in.
We created this monster called climate change. This responsibility is the real meaning of the term Anthropocene. We don't need to be destroyed by our creativity. However, time is running out, and we need to mobilize for global scale action right now. We've reached the tipping point, socially as well as scientifically.
As Bill McKibben tirelessly points out, the maths of 350 parts per million carbon in the atmosphere is beyond cultural differences. This is what creates the greenhouse effect, and the devastating changes that are now underway cannot be denied. But they can be swept beneath the carpet, for the time being at least. And this is exactly what the mainstream media are doing. Oh, they'll report on climate destruction, as they will on all sensational events that sell units and create clicks. But not with the advice that we should change our ways, that we should turn our backs on the outdated myth of endless progress and profit and rebuild our communities on a kinder, more earth-friendly scale. Prometheus was a brilliant thief who stole firepower from the gods for our purposes and suffered the consequences on our behalf. But the ancient Greeks who honoured him were already devoted to their polis or city and looked down upon the pagans or countryside dwellers. Just as the ancient Mesopotamians before them believed themselves to be more sophisticated in their urban way of life than the barbarians beyond the city walls. And this ancient division between city living and the rest of nature shows a consistent shift away from identification with the more than human nature all around us. All too often, we lock ourselves away indoors and behind walls, indulging in merely human chatter and ignoring all the other voices of the earth. We need a much more open-minded conversation if we are to take into account all the aspects of life upon which we depend. In order for us to transform human society in line with what we know of anthropogenic climate change and its devastating impacts, we need to act with love and a keen eye for low-carbon futures. And we need to do so now. Telling ourselves any other story is simply indulging in a fantasy that has become self-destructive. The new paradigm is eco-mythic. It includes all life in a biodiverse matrix, of which we are a very powerful part. And it recognizes that we live in accord with great stories, which link us to truths that go beyond our mere selfish human inclinations. These truths remind us that we need to honour all life, not just our own desires. Our modern way of life and our modern myth is in need of an overhaul. And City Living Nature Calling points towards some of the possible ways that the Earth could be teaching us to live within our means. As Professor Norman pointed out, many other world leaders in design, planning, renewable energies and other creative industries were behind the scenes in Paris, working on practical developments to counter our carbon-heavy lifestyle.
So we need to tell these positive stories.
Yes.
And it's a bit like what I was saying about COP21 and the innovation.
Yeah.
To tell these positive stories so that people can understand. I actually really believe this is a long-term plan. People see real practical examples where things have been successful.
Just as we need to retain our love of inventiveness and technological prowess, and just as we need to listen to climate scientists and urban planners, as we've done in this episode, we also need to listen to the cultural leaders from the oldest living traditions on Earth. So join me, Dr. Jeffrey Berry, and the City Living Nature Calling crew as we further explore the eco-mythic dimensions across ancient myth, indigenous knowledges, new forms of community, and other expressions of our tireless human curiosity about how we can live best on this planet for now and for the future.